This is Mark Trodson, October 12, 2012. Take Shelter, Imagining the End of Time.
Dr. Trodson is new to our group. He has a very exciting topic. I'm sure you are here because of the topic, some of it, Imagining the End of Time. And Dr. Trodson is a candidate in the Analyst Training Program in Los Angeles. And has taught at Antioch in Los Angeles. And as you know, of course, we have an Antioch in Seattle. So without further time, I'm going to have Dr. Trodson come up and talk to us. Thank you.
We just flew into Seattle today, so but we brought the rain from Los Angeles. You'll be happy to know. So Tom Wilkinson, who I guess is on a shaman retreat right now, he gave me a call after I gave a version of this talk in Los Angeles, and he said that the group was really interested in these kind of topics. And so it'd be interesting to find out exactly what the interest is up here in Seattle. I kind of had, there's a lot of things that I could do. One thing that I decided to focus on this evening is about the change in the weather as it is looming of apocalypse in the Arctic. So I thought we could focus on that because that's closer to you than it is to us in Los Angeles. And then tomorrow, so I don't do it at the end, tomorrow I just want to let you know what I had in mind to do. To see if you're interested in doing that, is we're going to be able to spend a lot more time on some of the movies and images of apocalypse. But what I'm going to start off with is a kind of a seminar, a reading together, a seminar of a section from the Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious and the Red Book. So I think both of those are going to be interesting. We'll use a little bit of the Red Book tonight, the section on the scrutinies. And so if you're interested in that, I think we'll do a close reading of a part of the Archetypes of the Collective Unconscious as it relates to issues of working towards the eschaton, the end of time, and apocalypse, which is the revelation, which I'll get into tonight. And then after that, what I had in mind to do is to do a real close work with a movie by Andrei Tarkovsky called The Sacrifice, but the title actually is Sacrificatio, which is, as Jungians, we prefer. Down in Los Angeles, a lot of the Jungians are students of Edinger, so of course that's how Edinger would have put it, The Sacrificatio. And has anybody seen that? Okay. So working closely with the attitude that one takes toward the reality of the psyche, and that's portrayed very clearly in that film. Other films we'll be looking at is a bits from the new film that's out now called The Turin Horse. Has anybody seen The Turin Horse? Yeah? Yeah? It's good? Yeah. There's so many movies out now about the end of the world. I think that's why Tom asked us, you know, me to come up. The question really for us as Jungians is to say what's being motivated and what's activated here with all these images about the end of the world. Of course, issues of apocalypse and predictions of the end of the world happen all the time. I mean, there's been really no time in which somebody hasn't come out with a prediction that this is it. And so it occurs to me, really from a Jungian point of view, is that the distinction he makes in the Red Book between the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths is that just about every time, as you're looking at horizontal time, just about every time there is some interest in predicting and recognizing the potential of end at a particular time. And of course, usually for people, they predict the time's going to come at some point during their life, the fulfillment during their lifetime. There's very few people who say, well, it's going to happen 300 years from now, because then there's not as much interest of the person. We can go fishing. But that's one of the common elements of it. From the point of view of the spirit of the depths, which is a sense of a vertical sense of time. That's the sense of time that dreams have, where there is past, present, and future included at the same time. And the spirit of the depths is the distinction that Jung makes in terms of kind of a crossroads between his work as a scientific psychologist and somebody who was very active in contributing to the spirit of his time, of course, but then also recognizing through his active imagination with Philemon, it's in the Red and the Black books, he was introduced into the spirit of the depths, that is the experience, not the sense, not the idea, but the experience he had of relating to his soul from a different plane of experience than was the everyday or the 20th century, 19th and 20th century perspective. So we'll be looking at Turnhorse, because that really, there's very little horizontal or spirit of the time in that movie. It really goes to the spirit of the depths. A few other films that we'll look at. And in part, I wanted to do a lot of different scenes from these tonight, but it looks like our technology is such, it would probably try all our patience to try to go back and forth between little clips here. And we have the idea that it would be magic to go from this clip to that clip, but I don't want to overwhelm Brian. He's been nice enough. But again, tomorrow we'll have more time to go into these. The other film, it would be the film called Take Shelter. And that's the film of a man who is really alone and kind of, he's in this middle of the country, he's in the Midwest, he's kind of isolated from the culture of the coasts the way we are. There's no Jungian societies there. And he is faced with images of devastation and annihilation. And the only kind of feedback he gets from people in his community is that he's having a psychotic break, which he believes because his mother had a psychotic break some time before. But the question is really, how can we take this image other than to say that it's psychotic? I mean, he's related with sensitivity towards some aspect that's going on in the world, but he's isolated from any kind of frame of understanding how to understand that and how to process that therapeutically. So those are the three that we'll focus on. What I also thought tomorrow is there have been some people who've done group work around a particular kind of trauma with people who are experiencing sort of apocalyptic trauma. I mean, dreams and experiences, such as the man in Take Shelter, that are related to not just a fear of illness or danger befalling oneself, but a catastrophic kind of vision of danger befalling the whole collective. And so there's been people who've done group work around that. And so I'm going to offer that tomorrow after lunch. You eat first and then... And what we'll do is something that called a dream matrix. So this is what I propose. The people tomorrow will be up to you to decide if that's what you want to do. So if you're thinking about going tonight and you're thinking, well, I don't want to do a group or I don't want to talk about dreams, then we don't have to do it. There's more material. But I thought I'd offer that to do some analytic work around the notion of a dream matrix. And so it's not interpreting individual dreams as you would in a session, but it's bringing the images out and working with them collectively as they come up in the group of people who are there. And so we're not making comments people's, how they reflect on a person's personality or complexes, but in a sense, what they tell us about what's coming up in the group. So if anybody has any kind of dreams tonight related to the images that we're looking at, you may want to come in and there'll be an opportunity to put that into the dream matrix, and then we can work with that. So that's just an idea of what I had in mind for tomorrow, and welcome for that. But tonight we'll be practicing a psychological analysis. So we're not doing, as Jung often says, he's not doing metaphysics, he's not doing theology or politics or ecology. There's all these different lenses on that we have on apocalypse and eschatology being a focus, knowledge of the end of things. But a psychological exploration of the topic of the end of time, the annihilation of human race and the planet, the coming of the apocalypse, of Armageddon. So is everybody in the right room? such a nice, it was a nice, almost sunny day today, right? So why are we doing this? Well, because even though it's certainly not a new fascination, as I said, it's very much up in the collective imagination of our age in all forms of media, science, religion, politics, art, psychology. So as I've been thinking about this topic, somebody asked me to do it last year, and then you can't open the paper without some new thing coming through. So my wife and I are, well, she mostly reads the paper in the morning, but brings out these issues. And so just in the last few weeks, thinking about coming here, we've all read about the extinction, the possible extinction of the axolotls. Do you know what the axolotls are? I think they're called the smiling salamanders. And so among many species that are going extinct now, and however that's measured, the axolotl is one of them. The interesting thing about the axolotl is that it is it has mythic significance for the Mexican people. It's sort of it's a god. It's an image of transformation, death. It's a psychopomp in a sense, and it only thrives and lives in one waterway, I think, in Mexico, which is becoming so polluted it's not able to support the life of that. And so the question would be, what happens when not just this species dies, but a species that is so central to the mythic and archetypal imagination of a people? So that's just one example that comes up. This is what's at stake here. And the question is, what happens with that archetypal image? Does it just go into the psyche, back into the psyche from whence it came? How does it affect the people in terms of how they relate to, in their culture, to issues of death and life? Because that animal had been the embodiment of that transition. Last week, new research showing about the CO2 and killing shellfish, and in a way how we're all related in terms of how it's affecting us. So the ecology and the politics of this is something we can go to, but the question is, how do we deal with this psychologically, in terms of these concepts of revelation and eschatology? So it's the psychologist's job to see and understand and help one cope in some way with the symptoms. In medical model psychology, we want to help one become more adaptive. But then the question arises, why would one want to become more adaptive to this situation? Is that really the focus? Is the psychology adequate to the task? Is adaptation what's looked for, or is something else what we're looking for? Or do we want to take, I think, more Jungian view, help one see a potential for development as a sign that some change could, should, or must be attempted, as opposed to putting up blocks to the way the energy is tending? If the energy of the psyche is tending for us in our popular culture and in our dreams to take a look at these experiences it's forcing itself upon us, then we have an obligation to look at it. So this second type of psychology is the one closer to what Jung is articulating. So as a Jungian psychologist, so what is my credo or our credo? And we can have more of a discussion about this tomorrow. But to me, and we probably would all pick one aspect of what Jung wrote about that really speaks to us in terms of our work in analysis or as analysts or as psyches, as people. I start off with the belief in the autonomous psyche and that it generates through us archetypal impressions, which are elements of how we imagine the world in which we live. So that's the basic model. I think it goes back to von Franz's story, which I'm sure many of you have heard about, the first time she met Jung as a young college student. And he told her about a patient he was working with who, he said, well, she lived on the moon. So you've heard this story. And von Franz said, Well, you mean she thought she should believe she lived on the moon? And Jung said, no, she was on the moon. And von Franz said, well, either this old man is crazy or I'm stupid, or else I'm going to have to think a long time for what that means. And she realized pretty quickly, because she wasn't a person who took to thinking that she was stupid at all, or crazy, very rational, philosophical person. She realized that what Jung meant is that the psyche is real, and the images of the psyche are real, the reality of the psyche. We tend to, all of us tend, even Jungians, we tend to think of psyche as something either in us, in our imagination, as opposed to something that is around us and that surrounds us and in which we live. And that's the notion of the autonomous psyche. That is, it's autonomous of our individual ways of looking at things. It's autonomous of our human psychology. It is the surround rather than the within only. It's not merely subjective. It is autonomous and objective. We don't experience ourselves, and we're not the authors of our experiences or even our fantasies. And dreams come to us ready-made with images and symbols that surpass our willful and deliberate invention. So I believe it's the experience, it's my experience as an analytic psychologist and phenomenologist, that the primordial and archetypal images come through my mind and I become a host for these thoughts and feelings. And who I am is constituted by these thoughts and feelings as I reflect on them and see them mirrored in the eyes of others who either see and confirm or disconfirm my subjective self. I mean, if you look at your own house or office in which you practice, you see nothing but reflections of aspects of your own psyche, things that you value, things that puzzle you, and your patients do too, for those of us, probably a lot of therapists in the room. Your patients may be looking at that picture. What does that mean about the person? I mean, we all know from The Sopranos how much Tony Soprano made of that picture on the wall of his psychiatrist's office and how much he projected into it. So we surround ourselves with memories of who we are and desires of who we wish to be. So we are in the psyche. It's not in us. All that surrounds us is the field of our experience, and it comes to us as not created by us, but given to us as present to our experience. And so the distinction that Jung is making in terms of the relation between our individual egos in this autonomous psyche is one that I think is going to be instructive for what we're going to be talking about tonight. In various ways, he makes the distinction between our commitment to an ego person, ego psychology, and how it relates to a greater self. And the sense that we have is that we are loyal, in a sense, and we believe in the reality of the ego psychology more so than in the splinter psyches that we experience outside of ourselves through projection and through imagination and creation. The sense in which we, rather than take stock of certain aspects of ourself that we don't wish to think about, we tend to see those in other people, and we tend to see those in the films and the news and things like that, the projective process. So, what I want to do is start with an image. And you know what? I think I can just go to a few images and go to the image on here so we can use this. And this is from... thanks. This is from the film Melancholia. Have you seen Melancholia? Yeah. Melancholia I thought of because I work with teenagers, and a few of the teenagers, a lot of them are interested in the Mayan prophecy. I ask them why, and they're kind of interested in the idea that the world's going to end, because I think that's kind of a teenage anxiety anyway. I don't know, we all went through a hypochondriacal phase probably. Because in a sense what's going on with them is that there's small bursts of a self and there's little deaths of a self in teenage years. They kind of go up and down. They change so often. We're a lot more stable. I can say that's why it's you know, it's easier working with teens in a way. I mean, nobody wants to work with teens, but I tell you, it's easier working with teens because they're naturally changing. All of us really are more stable in our ways, and we're much more harder nuts to crack, I tell you, in analysis than teens are. But the other thing that some of these kids are interested in is this idea of a planet called, or a satellite called Nibiru. Anybody heard about that? Yeah. It's one of the many things they get on the internet, and of a planet coming and hitting our planet. And there's something really compelling about that image. So I want to... now, I brought Blu-rays because I thought it was going to be really good image here, but I'm going to use the non-Blu-ray version of this just to give the last scene of it. So it is giving away the last scene. But it's pretty clear where it's going to go through the whole film. There's more to make of the trajectory of this, but I just want to give the image here. I won't even say what I kind of appreciate in that. You might have your own responses. So let me just play that. There's sound. It's Wagner's Liebestod. Tristan and Isolde. So you can just hear that. So Melancholia was a planet that was supposed to fly nearby the Earth, but as it turned out, the scientists were wrong, or they weren't telling us. And can I get lighter? So this is the image of the eschaton, clearly of the end. And it's such a strong symbol. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't even be inclined to want to interpret. But anything comes to you from looking at that? There's a little backstory in terms of how they got in that lean-to that's kind of interesting. The sister, they're both sisters, and the one sister thought, "Welcome, the world just ended. You're just in time." One of the sisters was very depressed, the blonde-haired one. She had been depressed through her whole life. The other sister was pretty anxious, very very anxious. The dark-haired sister, anxious sister, thought that they would just go out when the planet hit by drinking some wine on the veranda, and that it would be nice. She wanted to be nice. She wanted everything to be nice. The other sister said, "That's crazy. There's no way we're gonna do this. We have to stay awake and do this." But what she did that was interesting, the young boy said, "Is the planet really coming?" And she said, "That we can make a magic, not a castle, but a magic shelter, a magic shelter." And now she didn't say that the planet was going to hit, but what they made was a magic shelter to contain and hold that inevitability. And so that's Lars von Trier, the European bad boy, but the European version of the end. I want to give us the American version here before we go on to... Chevy runs deep. That's not quite what Jung had in mind with the spirit of the deep. However, now these are two opposites, and let me just read what Jung has to say in the Red Book about working with symbols like this. I think it's instructive, if I can read it. Understanding is a terribly binding power, possibly a veritable soul murder when it levels out vitally important differences. The core of the individual is a mystery of life, which dies when it is grasped. That is also why symbols want to keep their secrets. They are mysterious not only because they are unable to clearly see what is at their... We are unable to clearly see what is at their bottom. All understanding as such, being an integration into general viewpoints, contains the devil's elements and kills. That is why in the later stages of analysis, we must help the other to come to those hidden and unopenable symbols in which the seed of life lies securely hidden like the tender seed in the hard shell. Actually, there must not be any understanding and agreement on this, even if it were possible, as it were. But if understanding and agreement on this has become generalized and obviously possible, the symbol is ripe for destruction, because it no longer covers the seed, which is about to outgrow the shell. Now I understand a dream I once had, and which greatly impressed me. I was standing in my garden and had dug open a rich spring of water, which gushed forth mightily. Then I had to dig a trench and a deep hole, in which I collected all the water and let it flow back into the depths of the earth again. In this way, salvation is given to us in the unopenable and unsayable symbol, for it protects us by preventing the devil from swallowing the seed of life. Now, this is from the Jung-Schmidt letters forthcoming, but this is a footnote in the scrutinies section, page 337 of the Red Book. This is my argument by authority. While I'm not going to give you any answers and interpretations of the symbols, so now we're going to be working with them, without coming to an answer, but to see different ways that we can contain and process them. So the thing to remember with Revelation is used interchangeably with the end or the destruction, the catastrophic destruction. But of course, Revelation and Apocalypse mean to be unconcealing. The Apocalypse, there were a lot of Apocalypses written, and the Apocalypse tends to be the uncovering of a supernatural or transcendent or religious truth opening up within the everyday world. So it's an unconcealing, it's an opening up, it's something becoming conscious, it's something coming up from the depths. It's not necessarily the end. The Christians and the Muslims thought of it as the disclosure, final disclosure of the kingdom of God. So when people read, say, the Apocalypse of John, the Revelations in the Christian Bible, they're taken by the grotesque images and the images of pain and suffering and all of the kind of horrible images. The thing that's important to note about that is that that's all leading to the final open disclosure of the kingdom of God. These are the images of how people are living before that. And I would suggest that these are the images of the ways that we are living. They're more vivid and more grotesque, because the point of it is to open one's eyes to these shadow aspects of one's life, and to recognize how we're living in this way right now. I think that was also the point that Dante had in the Inferno, when the people who were in the levels of hell were suffering the punishments of the sins and offenses they had in life. The reason they were suffering them is because you suffer from the offense at the time that you commit the offense. And if you don't recognize the offense, you continue to live with the suffering of the offense until you're released from that. There was a movie, I won't show the clip from it, but called The Rapture, and it was about a woman who, you know, lived a shadow life until she became a Christian, and she became a really strongly committed Christian, committed to this notion of the end of time, to the point where she went out to a desert because she felt this is what she needed to do, and waited for God to take her up into the heavens. And when God didn't do it, she shot her daughter and said, take her. If you won't take me, you're not taking me, because I'm not good enough to take her. So after that happened, she sort of jumped the gun. After that happened, the actual full Apocalypse of John happened in the movie, with the four horsemen and everything. And the end of the movie has her standing in the dark across from this river, where she is. She has a sense of what heaven is. It's in the dark across from her, but she has a sense that it's there, but she can't see it. And her daughter comes across to her and says, "Mother, come with me." And then a man, a policeman who she was with, he goes over to the other side. And then she stands there and she says, "No, I will not go. I choose not to go, because I'm not going to go to be with a God who would allow me to, or would put me in a situation where I'd kill my own daughter." And so she was left in her hell, which her daughter says, "You'll have to stay there forever." She's going to stay there as long as it takes for her to recognize and to settle that issue in her own soul that keeps her from the heaven. So the issue of the Jungian work about Revelation is that the work that one has to do in revealing the unconscious or revealing individually and collectively is the work that we're facing now, and it begins in shadow work, so that is the least interesting part of Jungian analysis for people who have been in it, but it's what has to be done to go to recognize and bring up and to find out more about the parts of your soul that you have been split off from. The work of shadow work is to return these aspects of yourself to yourself, to take ownership of them, to integrate them with yourself, as opposed to keeping them distant from you. In which case they look foreign, they seem attacking. There's something that you're fearful of. And this is what we do when we project them onto other people, the strangers that we face, and so on. So now Jung's work in the Red Book, Scrutinies, I won't go into that so much. I think we'll go into it tomorrow more. Has anybody read that part of the Red Book, Scrutinies? Yeah. It's, well, let me just give you a flavor of it. It's his dialogue with himself before his soul comes to him in the form of the Philemon, the character Philemon. And a few passages, he says, "I resist, I cannot accept this hollow nothing that I am. What am I? What is my I? I always presuppose my I. Now it stands before me. I before my I. I speak now to you, my I. We are alone, and our being together threatens to become unbearably boring." "Pitiful creature, I will torment you a bit if you don't make an effort. What are you moaning about? Perhaps the whip will help. How now? You want to speak, but I won't let you. Otherwise, in the end, you will claim that you are my soul. But my soul is in the upper sources. Do I know what he is doing there? But you are not my soul. You are my bare, empty nothing. You are laughably sensitive, self-righteous, unruly, mistrustful. One can hardly speak about your childish pride, your craving for power, your desire for esteem, your laughable ambition, your thirst for fame without feeling sick. The play-acting and pomposity become you badly, and you abuse them to the best of your ability. You complain that the torment has not yet come to an end. Let me tell you, it has only just begun. Only when it concerns your pleasure do you praise your patience. I will pin all your unjust and depraved words one by one to your body with needles so that you can feel how evil words stab. Your inordinate ambition is boundless. You do not work for humanity, but for your own self-interest. You speak skillfully and abuse your capability and discolor, tone down, strengthen, apportion light and shade, and loudly proclaim your honorableness and upright good faith. You exploit the good faith of others. You gloatingly catch them in your snares and speak of your benevolent superiority and the prize that you are there for others. You play at modesty and do not mention your merit in the certain hope that someone will do it for you. You are disappointed and hurt if that doesn't happen. If I tame you, beast, give others the opportunity to tame their beasts. I give others the opportunity to tame their beasts. The taming begins with you, my I, nowhere else. Not that you, stupid brother, I had been particularly wild. There are some others who are wilder, but I must whip you until you endure and the wildness of the others. You want to be understood? That's all we needed. Understand yourself and you will be sufficiently understood. You will have quite enough work in hand with that. Mother's little dears want to be understood. Understand yourself. That is the best protection against sensitivity and satisfies your childless longing to be understood. So he said, after I had spoken these and many more angry words to my eye, I noticed that I began to bear being alone with myself. So that's the nature of the shadow work, is that as you come into relation to those aspects of yourself, you become, as he said, more familiar with the silence in yourself, and you tend to be more open to doing the work that it takes to be responsible for those aspects of yourself, again, rather than projecting them out to the stranger and the other. Okay. So the revelation is not of the end, but when and what occurs that leads up to the revealing or the unconcealing of the kingdom of God. In other words, the bad things get amplified and the conscious position gets worse before the true nature of things is revealed and the time of peace can be at hand. And we know what that would look like. I think this person's from Seattle, but there's a group that puts out a publication called Reality Sandwich. Is that a Seattle? Pinchbeck, yeah. There was something they put out called Transmission 2012, and it's not even much of a technical problem to know what it would take or what it would look like to have this kind of sense of sort of peace and justice. What gets in our way is the psychological barriers that we put up with ourselves by remaining unconscious of that we are the other, or projecting onto the stranger. So here's some examples of the values of perspectives: an increased emphasis on connectedness and interdependence, a shift toward cooperation and away from competition. Individuals choose for themselves rather than taking their cues externally. Harmony with nature. These are the principles that we know. Barry Commoner just died, and remember his four principles of ecology: everything is related to everything else. You have you need space. You have to put, what was the second one? You have to put, everything needs to be put somewhere, right? So these are the values that we could take. But why is it that we're not taking these? Well, in a sense, we are at the end of a period of time where we have become so committed to the ego sense and not related to the spirit of the depths that we are following through on the Faustian mode, as Jung would say, as opposed to the model that's presented by Philemon and Baucis. So I want to tell you about that a bit. Are you familiar with the the last act of Faust? When Faust, who has Jung thought of as being the model really for his soul, he was the philosopher who knew everything, the alchemist who knew everything, the scientist. In fact, Jung had some fantasy that he was related to Goethe, and Goethe wrote the most famous version of Faust. But at the end of Faust, after Faust has gone through the world and not found satisfaction in anything, his ego has not found any place that he would want to rest and say, this is a place where I'll rest. This is good enough for me. I'll stay here a while. This is a beautiful place. The restless intellect. He had this, at the end of the Faust II, he had this reclamation project to build over the ocean where it couldn't be built. And he was going to build and be the master of the world. He was going to build over a swamp, and this came up when I was down in New Orleans, and we were having a Jungian conference talking about what had happened with New Orleans, who they built below the water. They told me that New Orleans is like in a bowl, and so of course the levees are around. So the sense of hubris that comes from building where you're not supposed to build, this is the sense of Faust. And at the end of Faust, he wants to do this reclamation project, but there's these two old people, Philemon and Baucis, who have a hut in the area that he's going to try to build. And he tells Mephistopheles, try to evict these people. And as it turns out, Mephistopheles is sinister, is the devil. It turns out that he ends up killing them, burning them in their house. And so Jung took this as really the essence of the challenge of his life. He said that in a letter to a friend, he said, you have hit the mark absolutely. All of a sudden and with terror, it became clear to me that I have taken over Faust as my heritage, and moreover as the advocate and avenger of Philemon and Baucis, who, unlike Faust the Superman, are host of the gods in a ruthless and God-forsaken age. I would give the earth to know whether Goethe himself knew why he called the two old people Philemon and Baucis. Philemon and Baucis, I think they mean kiss and embrace. They are they represent the value of embracing, of taking in, of hospitality. Of hospitality toward the stranger. And the story from Ovid is that Philemon and Baucis, during a godforsaken age when two of the gods, I believe it was Mercury and Jupiter and Mercury, were going house to house and to see if anybody would let them in, anybody would recognize them and relate to them and let them in. Nobody had any time for them. Which is kind of the sense that one gets when one is with a panhandler or something. You don't know who it is that's coming to you. The sense of hospitality in every culture, from the most ancient culture and as broadly as we look, has a sense of hospitality toward the stranger. And in many of them, it's because you don't know if the stranger is a god. Or more explicitly, the god is in the stranger. And so what you do to the stranger is you're doing to the god. So the hospitality is a key attitude toward the stranger and toward the stranger in oneself, toward the god in oneself. So Faust represents the ego, the aggrandized, grandiose, narcissistic ego who believes that he is everything to himself, that he is sufficient unto himself, and that he doesn't need all the other parts around him. And so the two plays of Faust are just incident after incident where he misses the opportunity to even take care. When he meets a figure named Care, Zorga, he brushes her aside. He doesn't even recognize the care that he has about how he's affecting others, and certainly no guilt and no shame. But it begins with care, and he's missing that capacity. And I think Jung was very focused on that. He was known to be, bitter, angry, and lashing out at people. He had, quite a bit of the grandiosity in himself. I mean, we would all of us grant him that. I mean, he was a man of great achievement. However, in his own mind and in the work in the Red Book we see now in terms of the scrutinies, he recognized the insufficiency of this, and asked, as he asked others to do, or he didn't ask others to do, but he suggested we might consider this, is to reflect on these negative parts of oneself and the gods in one, as if they were gods in oneself, to be able to recover them, to honor them, to show hospitality toward them. So he continues, when Faust in his hubris and self-inflation caused the murder of Philemon and Baucis, I felt guilty, quite as if I myself in the past had helped commit the murder of these two old people. This strange idea alarmed me, and I regarded it as my responsibility to atone for this crime or to prevent its repetition. And he wrote in a letter to a woman who wrote a really fine book on the Faust. Who is that for you? Alice Raphael, Goethe and the Philosopher's Stone. He wrote the preface to that, and he wrote a letter to her telling her that Philemon is equals kiss, or the loving one, the simple old loving couple, close to the earth and aware of the gods, the complete opposite to the Superman Faust, the product of the devil. Incidentally, in my tower at Bollingen is a hidden inscription, Philemon Sacrum Fausti Penitentia. When I first encountered the archetype of the old wise man, he called himself Philemon. So the Latin is Philemon Sacrum. Philemon's place, his sacred place, is sanctuary. Philemon's sanctuary, Faust's penitence. So Jung had a sense that he was in his place that he built, the Bollingen Castle and the tower, that this was a sanctuary for Philemon, And not just, of course, in that physical place, but in his own meditations, in his own self, to have a sense of hospitality toward those aspects in himself that were rejected, that could be rejected, as he did in the scrutinies. So, I want to skip to this section of the last winter, and I think the last winter is a story that takes place in the Arctic, and it takes place between two. There's a kind of conflict between two men. They both work for the oil company. One is there, the ecologist, to protect and to do studies to show that whether or not it's safe to drill. And, of course, the other character is the one who wants to drill baby drill at any cost. Now, the reason why this fits into the apocalyptic vision and is relevant to what I'm bringing up in terms of Revelation is the uncovering of shadow material and of the hospitality toward those aspects of ourselves that we've put down into the shadows or in the permafrost, is that what is actually happening, as we know with the warming, is that the permafrost is melting. And the fantasy here that we're going to see in these clips is one that... I want to read this one last thing from the Sharon Rose. I think she's from Seattle. Sharon here? I'll give her credit if she's here. But she portrays this beautifully. This film really is illustrating this brief point that she makes. She says, think about it. The 20th century, with all of its inventions, wars, and change, was brought to us by the power of one single substance, oil. Over the course of the last 100 years, during the age of oil, we have used up millions of years of compacted light created by the bones and residue of the plants and animals that once occupied this planet. On a metaphysical level, that means our very environment is suffused with the ka, or psychic residue of these living beings from the past. Is the age of oil an outer manifestation of the karmic traces, seeds of destruction left from the inhabitants of former age? It certainly appears so. And we'll see a little bit of what that looks like. So can we go to chapter 2? So this is the... I'm going to see a few scenes from this. This is, in a sense, if you look at these two men as two aspects of one man, and I know we can do that as Jungians.
I could do it along the runway.
Sounds like a personal problem,
Gary.
This
is Faust.
It's on my list, that's for sure. Go get my gear, will you?
Faustian figure.
Why, Ed?
Motor! Rise and shine!
Very confident.
Where's my welcoming party?
Faust coming to reclaim his project.
Abby, goddammit, you're beautiful. You took my room. I want it back. You win it.
Hi, Ed. How you doing?
100% abs. 150.
Yeah, put on a few.
Well, you know.
Is that Ed Pollock I hear?
Come on, baby, you sight for sore eyes.
How's that new exercise regime going?
Okay.
The man of confidence.
Put me down. Dinner's almost ready.
Very little shadow reflection.
Lee, you're far too excitable.
Yeah, Lee, pipe down.
It is good to see this team taking shape here. You know, the big boys, they send their love. Everybody's gearing up. Where's the kid?
Oh, Maxwell is out on the flats. Should be back by now.
I'm supposed to keep my eye on him, you know, for the old man.
Gary's taking off. He wanted to beat the snow.
I wanted him to stay for a drink. Hey, Don, find some glasses, will you? Boy, he's sure in a hurry.
What you got in the bag, boss?
Mind your damn manners, Motor. Hey, Don, where's those glasses?
Oh, this is Elliot Taylor. He is doing the impact evaluations.
I thought the new green flag was named Hoffman.
That's my boss.
They sent two guys?
That's what you were looking for, Motor?
Hmm? Little fish, cigarettes.
This one looks sexy.
Ooh.
Stogies. And more fish. Is this going to be Maxwell?
Hi.
James Hoffman, meet Ed Pollock.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
So, you know, one of the perspectives here with this house is that, and the Jungian analyst Wolfgang Gigerich makes this point, is that
now I know you've all been in a holding pattern, and I want to apologize for that.
So we can bring it down. We'll go to the next section. So what I want to point out that we're just seeing here's the alter ego in a sense of the. Of the industrialist, or the pawn of the industrialist, the Faustian character. Wolfgang Gigerich, in an article called Saving the Bomb, a very provocative thinker, but he makes the provocation is that, you know, there's two positions that people take on the bomb. One is that some people are trying to dismantle it, and others are trying politically to fight against it. So, but he makes the provocative point that the psychological attitude that we need to take toward the bomb is to understand where it came from, how it came from us. Right? Different than the melancholia. Although melancholia comes, the image of melancholia in that movie comes from our own psyche. It's reminding us and having us think about something that we don't want to think about. Perhaps it's having us, the melancholia movie is having us think about the possibility that we aren't the chosen ones, that the psyche can evolve past our species, that as the axolotl, we can go as well. That doesn't fit in with any of our stories, even in the Revelation and Apocalypse. The stories always end with a transformation to a different stage, and usually a stage in which we come to our completion. So the one of the deep symbols about the melancholia is that somehow we were wrong about ourselves and our species, and we're not special in that way. We're not the elect. So that might be one of the ways to look at that. In this case, Gigerich makes the point in looking at the bomb, what the bomb says. He talks first about our relation to nature, and he says some interesting thing, I think, for this for these images, is that there was a time, and maybe for some there's still a time, there was a time when nature was bigger than us. It encompassed us. It was a container that was within which we lived, and still is, really, but the sense is that we were contained by nature. Now it seems that Gigerich says, it doesn't seem, he claims that it is, that nature is contained by us. That is, the fact that we need nature conservancy groups, that we need to protect nature, that we need to have protection of animals and this and that, means that man is now in the position, specifically man, I mean women too, but Faust is a man, and most of his victims were women along the way, to remind you, we are encapsulating nature within us, in our zoos, with the people who we consider to be more natural or in nature, as in Children of Men, the movie Children of Men. There's the distinction between the British and the Fugees, the refugees. And the refugees in the movies are in cages. The people from other countries other than England, the colonials. And so the sense is that what had once been Mother Nature and our relation to it was with the archetype of the containing mother, now has become the child that needs our care. So it's a reversal of the image. So now the nature goes from being the mother, the encompassing one, The one that we see in, say, the alchemical work, the Atalanta Fugiens, is being sort of the, having the globe in her belly, if you know this image, to the one where now nature is sort of smaller and compartmentalized and something that we need to care for. Okay, and in a sense, probably our experience would be if there's anything that contains us now, it's probably, in a sense, the Faustian corporate environment that we live in. That's probably more of our experience now. In Los Angeles, maybe. I don't, maybe it's still in Seattle. It's, look, there's rain in here. But the sense in which the globe has become very small and something that is... Gingrich makes the point is that there was a time that no matter what heinous and egregious thing that one could do in nature, like cut down a bristlecone pine or something, I mean, maybe that would be most egregious, you couldn't kill nature, right? But now with the bomb and with with oil, the use of oil, we're in a situation where nature is apparently subordinate to the power motive of the human. So, as we're going to see in this next scene, there's a sense in which the next step of the story doesn't go in quite the way that Faust might have thought. So I think that's 7. You go to 7. Conflict now between the guy who's wearing the skin on his head, he wants to bring in the big trucks.
Take
and
him out here first.
Put the oil in. Now, look, here's the image where the nature is bigger than these. They look very small against the background.
19th, and then we're going to get them over to the northeastern site. I mean, you know, we just tell them that, you know, like it's a done deal.
Yeah, well, you tell them that, Adam. Jesus.
I'll handle them. Is this Maxwell flagging these sights? What is he, sniffing glue out here or what?
I don't know what this is.
Jesus. You're going to have to check all these sights now.
Yeah. Lee, this is going to be you, all of them.
Will do. Excuse me.
You're going to have your work cut out for you.
Yeah, I think this is going to take more than one of us.
Better you than me. Oh, nature calls.
So, Hoffman, what do you figure? We bring the rigs in here on roller guns? Is that going to work?
Oh, the tundra is barely frozen. Won't support the weight of those vehicles.
Well, now,
I can't help but be reminded of Freud's story about how culture developed when we learned how to piss on the fire.
Maybe you won't get it in.
Man's initial power comes from that.
You're going to have to reconsider your plans.
That's the wrong answer.
It's the CO2 feeding back up. As the ground warms, permafrost, all this organic material that's been frozen for thousands of years, is thawing, which accelerates the warming. It's exponential, what we're talking about here.
What is this, some global warming bullshit? I mean, don't you think it's a little late in the day to be having that particular debate?
Not a debate about global warming, Ed. It's just what we're dealing with out here now.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I don't have to listen to you anymore.
You asked.
Just making conversation.
Learned in childhood. has changed. The biosphere turned, become unfamiliar and erratic. I would say vengeful, but nature's indifferent to us. We fight for our survival, not nature's. There's a fierceness in the wind I've never felt before. Something is being unleashed from the softening permafrost. Why do we despise the world that gave us life? Why so alienated? Why wouldn't the wilderness fight us like any organism would fend off a virus? The world we grew up in is changed forever. There is no way home. Is there something beyond science that is happening out here? What if the very thing we were here to pull out of the ground were to rise willingly and confront us? What would that look like? This is the last winter. Total collapse. Hope dies.
It ends with it raining, and the woman who's the cook, the woman who's the cook uses an Inuit word when they said, "What do you call that when it rains in February?" And then the word means a familiar friend acting strangely. So the I'm going to get your response to it too, but just to sort of underline again is that the sense of the danger in a sense is not out there. The danger, obviously, in terms of the people there. I mean, the world is changing and it's dangerous to the living things there, polar bears and people and so on. But the real danger that we see in here is in the soul of these men, these two men, in terms of the attitudes they're taking toward their life. You know, on the planet and with each other, and the impact of the warming. He says, we're not going to have this debate anymore about global warming. That's just the situation that we're in. But the fantasy here, just as Sharon Rose said, is to take seriously that what we put down, what we repress and put down into the, what we think is the permafrost, you know, the beings that have already become extinct, their spirits in the sort of I wouldn't want to say the fantasy in the psyche of the film, their spirits are now being released as the permafrost is opening. In the same way as we know from analysis, when we start opening up the kind of frozen covered areas in our life, then some of these spirits will come back, and they usually come back with a vengeance at first. They come back big and frightening, and it's a very good reason why we want to, you know, don't want the rain. We want the snow to come back and keep them down. What actually happens in this film is it really plays through the fantasy image of that and what's coming back as the permafrost melts and the plant matter and the animal matter comes up. The spirit of these animals actually comes up out of it, and not as full monsters like Godzilla, but more more spiritual kind of beings. They're not incarnated, but they have the power also return and to their old ways, which is exactly what again material that's repressed and unconscious will do, and on a collective level. So what we're working here with is not just the kind of work that we would do individually with our own shadow material, as if we ever could, because as you work analytically with material, it's not that the material is only personal. It becomes familial, it becomes tribal, it becomes collective, it has aspects of a cultural complex as well as other complexes that show the effect of archetypes of the collective unconscious, which is what we look at tomorrow, Jung's notion of the collective unconscious. Already in his psychology, he departs from Freud in not being an individual psychologist, but a collective psychologist. So the psychological perspective that he can take toward the issue of Revelation and Armageddon suits itself very well to the collective notion. It's something that we face, each of us individually, but it's an archetype of transformation that's on a collective level. That's the point. So even in Melancholia, there's the three people there. The strength of it is the collective level. In The Last Winter, he says, it's the last winter. It's the last winter that we would experience. So I just want to take a minute. I know you usually take a break. I'm just thinking that could we should we take a break just to get coffee and cookies and have a discussion a bit, and I have a few more things just to finish up with, or how do you feel? Would you like to do that? Okay. So again, there are a lot of ways, and tomorrow we'll go into more depth in terms of the image and discussion, and as I said, start off with kind of a seminar or a close reading of some of the aspects of of the archetypes of the collective unconscious. Some of the man who's part of your society who invited me here, he said he was particularly interested in people who are working with psychoactive agents and such as ayahuasca and things like that. And in my sense of that, so there's a question about that in terms of how they would be helpful with this kind of work. I mean, recognizing the two points I'm trying to make is that revelation is not really an end. It's an unconcealing, it's an opening, and a hospitality toward, which opens with a hospitality toward sometimes the gruesome and scary things that we're facing. The cost of not facing them is that they tend to get bigger, they tend to get meaner. So, for example, in Gigerich's point about how the archetype of the containing mother has now become the needy child, nature is the needy child. Well, as we know from children, is that particularly if you abuse them or mean to them, they get mean themselves. And so it's not just a needy child that we have if we're containing this nature and animals and think of ourselves as being capable of protecting all our whole environment here, but it comes back with a vengeance, and I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, we're seeing nature coming back. Not that it has a vengeance, that would be to psychologize it too much, but it comes back very strong, and it in the word of hospitality, the Latin, there's two roots of it. One is a root of master, and one is a root of stranger. So there's a sense in which when you need both. because when somebody is a stranger and they're coming to a person who is able to give hospitality, that person, insofar as they're able to give, is a sense in a mastery position and has the responsibility of the power of that mastery position. And the person who's the stranger has a certain responsibility too, clearly not to steal from your host, hence the Trojan War, right? Helen was stolen. That the whole war, the Trojan War was over a break of hospitality. As we know, that was because Agamemnon had Paris in his house, and Paris stole his wife, and that was the breach of hospitality that led to the war. So you have a guest-host relationship in terms of hospitality that has both. Each one has their own obligation, and they can meet in that obligation. They're opposites in a sense, but it's a way where opposites meet. And when the hospitality is broken, then it really breaks one of the most common and useful rules that we have of communal life. So the problem with the reversal of the archetype from the mother of nature to the child is that, particularly how we're treating the child is, we're not hosting the child very well. And as we know, childs can become, they become bratty in their own way. So the notion of the work that we can do, and the particularly of hospitality, is to take note of the Faustian image in ourselves, as Jung does in the Red Book. It's his own private journals, but in his own discovery of depth analysis with himself as a subject, he found out the value of doing that kind of shadow work of interrogating his I, interrogating himself, and he did it on his own with the help of some of his analytic sisters, really, with von Franz to some extent, but Tony Wolf, and even in some ways Sabina Spielrein. That part wasn't really in the movie that you saw, but they were important figures for him to teach him about that notion of his own shadows and the importance of not taking a power attitude toward it, as he did, and with Freud, which would be Spielrein. Actually, he and Freud were corresponding between them about what are we going to do with the Spielrein woman. So he took a power attitude, but then after that, that's when he went into the Red Book phase and had all these things to say. I only read a few of them, but basically he didn't let himself off the hook much in terms of all the different aspects that. That, for example, were illustrated half fictitiously in the Dangerous Method movie. If he had continued and maintained the power attitude, it wouldn't have been as interesting. But of course, the movie ends right when he's right at the choice, when he's looking across the water there, and he's really at the juncture where he can make the choice. And we know what happens after that as he goes down into his scrutinies. Which is an old medieval, I think, Catholic practice before election or ordination, that you go in and you scrutinize, you do your shadow depth work before you can become a priest. So he did that work. So that's the notion of the hospitality of relating to these forces in oneself. And the gods in oneself, as Jung said, so that they don't come back to us, as he said, as symptoms or as powers that we have to contend with. So there's a two. I'm a little reluctant to give this poem because I was at a conference in New Orleans, and one of the analysts there got up and made a big deal about it. He says, we have to ban Rilke and Rumi and the rest of them from any society because we've heard it all too much. So, but Seattle isn't that way, right? So,
we've heard it all, but we like it.
You'd like it, yeah. So, That's how it works when somebody's complex, if just the power complex takes over a room like that. That was a year ago. So the attitude, as we all know, comes out most strongly in Rumi's poem, The Guest House. And so I think that's, as Jung said, he advised analysts and people, he says, don't give a lecture on depth psychology, analytical psychology, or complex psychology without telling the Rainmaker story, which you all know also, I think, the Rainmaker story. But I think that he would have also... use this poem really as very close to, you know, the deep archetype of hospitality that he said can keep us, can hold us in faith when we go through the dark and dismal work of the analytic work and face the dark and dismal environment that we're in, not to become discouraged, not become completely discouraged, but to take these things in and to try to grasp one's own measure of responsibility for them and one's own measure of ability or facility to do some part in working that. And Jung said many times that that working individually with the material that comes through your own incarnated psyche is doing the work of the collective also. Many people say that, but his psychology lends itself to the notion that that we really are as rhizomatically related with the egos, rhizomatically related to a more fundamental collective archetypal sense. So, the guest house, of course. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Now again, that's where the notion of apocalypse and revelation in the theological sense meets the psychological sense, because it is the meeting between the individual and the numinous, and the supernatural and the numinous. And in the theological sense, that's clearly what the stories want people to focus on. There is a relationship between the human and the divine element, and it's the job of the theological group to be able to facilitate that. But psychologically, it's the same thing in terms of revelation, the revelation and the unconcealing, the uncovering of one's splinter psyches, one's complexes, and so on. Not happy work, but good work if you could get it. So the idea of inviting them in is taking these Rumi says taking these dark aspects in are in a sense not filling us up more but clearing us out. If we meet them honorably, they're clearing us out for some new delight, and so we have to create some kind of shelter for them. And I won't, let's see, do we have, what time is it? Do we have?
It's quarter to nine.
A quarter to nine. Okay, I won't, well, you may choose to want to hear it. If you do, I will read the lyrics too. For some people, this, the American poet of the Dark Night of the Soul, Bob Dylan, is, goes on forever, but for some people he's just right. But I want to read also from our own Rumi is from our psychological culture, but Dylan's from our American culture. But I think he's capturing the same notion, really, of the connection of the transcendent and numinous divine elements, and how by coming into relation with those through the psychological work, we're doing our part in a recovery or an uncovering, a revelation of the kingdom that is promised, in a sense, in our own way. And so this is his song, Shelter from the Storm. I was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue and the road was full of mud. I came in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured, I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel-eyed death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us. There was little risk involved. Everything up to that point had been left unresolved. Try imagining a place where it's always safe and warm. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes, and blown out on the trail, hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Suddenly I turned around, and she was standing there, with silver bracelets on her wrists and flowers in her hair. She walked up to me so gracefully and took my crown of thorns. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Now there's a wall between us, something there has been lost. I took too much for granted, got my signals crossed, just to think that it all began, a long-forgotten morn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. Well, the deputy walks on hard nails, and the preacher rides a mount, but nothing really matters much. It's doom alone that counts. And the one-eyed undertaker, he blows a futile horn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. I've heard newborn babies wailing like a mourning dove, and old men with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question? Man, is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm. In a little hilltop village, they gambled for my clothes. I offered up.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.